What I remember most vividly is he seemed to be hanging around with some hot stewardesses, and he had a Rolls Royce, and a couple of other swell cars that he wasn't old enough to drive. These cars, and their drivers, didn't seem so spiritual to me, but I was told he had no attachment to them, so it wasn't a sign of his materialism. How do you argue with logic like that? I just figured this new Lord of the Universe was no idiot. What's he going to be driven around in? A Pontiac? Or, to quote the Bible, and the Lord saw the Rolls Royce, and it was a bitchin' ride. This was back in the early 70s, before conspicuous consumption became a good thing. A Rolls was an unusual sight, especially at a religious festival. And what was the kid dispensing that was enabling him to raise the money for a Rolls? And apparently a lot more? It was called, I shit you not, the knowledge. The knowledge. The secret. The truth. They've always got a name for whatever they're selling as the way. Most of my adulthood, I have preferred the secret truth for making the perfect martini. There's my path to enlightenment. The knowledge, as it turned out, was four different ways to meditate, and by doing so, you could achieve inner peace. All you had to do to receive the knowledge was attend a few meetings, and then sign up for the all-day session, where it would be given out to you. There was no charge for this. Actually, you were asked to bring a piece of fruit, like an apple. I guess once they had you hooked, they would go after the cash, like a heroin dealer who gives you the first free dose up front. Or maybe the knowledge compelled you to give your money to the kid. I had to see for myself just what this knowledge was. So when I moved to Maryland to work in a theater company, I went to a number of meetings of his followers at an ashram in Washington, D.C. These meetings were called satsangs, and it was at them that the converts talked about their experiences with the knowledge or how they felt about the kid. They were all grinning that grin that one finds only in the zealously religious. The kind of grin that says idiocy has replaced any form of real thought. These people were all harmless enough, and like any group that seeks converts, they were thrilled to have me around. They treated me just like one more moron to throw on the pyre of enlightenment. The meetings were always run by one of the kids' disciples who were all from India. Even in their pidgin English, the disciples seemed a lot more spiritual than their fearless leader. For starters, they were a lot older than 13, and that was comforting. They weren't surrounded by a circus of sycophants and a luxury car dealership. They also gave off the impression that they were completely at peace and at one with the universe. Finally, as they spoke of the meditation, they exuded truth and wisdom. On the day I was to receive the knowledge, I brought my apple and placed it in the basket. I was so skeptical about this, I'll bet you could have smelled it on me. Our teacher that day was actually my favorite of the guru's disciples, and he blew my cynical mind when he meditated in front of us, and within 30 seconds of his beginning to meditate, his skin became translucent, as if a light were shining through it. If that was a magic trick, it was fucking spectacular. No one commented on it. The room was absolutely silent. Once he had finished meditating, it was time for us to be given our four meditative techniques. I will not go through them for you. You want the knowledge? Cough up your own goddamn apple. I will tell you that we were told to close our eyes. Without going into details, I was instructed to focus on where my third eye would be. Easy enough, I had two eyes in my head, and there was the one-eyed monster in my pants. That made three. I was focused. You weren't supposed to watch as the instructor went from pupil to pupil, but I snuck a few peeks. He was barely touching anyone. So when he came to me, I am sure he was doing the same thing. But the effect was overwhelming. When he touched me, It was as if he had poked my eyes as hard as he could. It was such an overwhelming jolt that I felt as if my head was going to explode. The vague shapes and shadowy figures I had been seeing turned into a mandala of spectacularly vivid colors. My mind was seriously blown. If I was going to meditate, this was the meditation for me. I know I don't seem like the kind of person who would meditate, but at least I now had begun to understand what had attracted Gale to this outfit. It seemed pretty powerful, and I wanted to see where it would lead me. Despite my earlier skepticism, I actually found it fascinating. It seemed to be a gateway to the power of the mind. Still, it didn't seem all that spiritual to me, and it was totally separate from the 13-year-old kid. He was just the pitchman. Besides, it only cost an apple. I had paid a lot more for a lot less. So every afternoon, I sat upright and put a sheet over my head. Don't even ask. The first four times I meditated, not much happened. My body was no doubt adjusting to staying still for half an hour. Then, as now, I am not good at sitting still. I've always been a twitcher. But the fifth time I got under the sheet, all hell broke loose. Bright colors were spinning in circles, and everything around me was blue. Sky blue, to be exact. Holy shit, my consciousness flashed. I'm in the sky. I am in the fucking sky! It smells like the outdoors. And there's a cloud. It freaked the piss out of me. And just as soon as I realized I was in the sky, I wasn't anymore. That was that. I never tried to meditate again. That's how much it shook me up. It's one thing to watch someone's tie turn into a snake while you're on some hallucinogen. It's quite another thing to be sober and float around in the sky while your body is in the living room. It is the only out-of-body experience I have ever had. I know I was in the sky. I know I saw that cloud. No one ever talked about this kind of experience at satsang, and that was the problem. These guys knew how to hook us up to our interior, but they didn't seem to know how to guide us out. They didn't really communicate how the interior reality and the exterior reality could be brought into balance. They didn't warn us that we would be tripping our brains out. At least the first guy who gave me acid gave me that little talk beforehand. I call that responsible. Now, my grip on reality has always been tenuous at best. I'm the kind of person who needs balance. I have always taken my clues from what I see around me. It's my guide. And if I was going to be going God knows where when I closed my eyes, I needed a reliable guide, not some 13-year-old sitting in the back of a Rolls Royce. I never talked to Gale about this. I didn't have to. The unrequited love died in the sky. I went from serious meditation back to heavy masturbation. They both calm you down, I found. And I saved a fortune on apples. The American Guru. At about the same time the kid from India was making his way around the United States, there was an American guru in waiting, hitting the highways in a big yellow school bus. I had heard about him from my brother, who had seen him in Ann Arbor, and the word about him was spreading quickly. It's amazing how even without the internet one used to pick up information. I guess people used to talk more, even to each other. Stephen Gaskins was a spiritual leader who came out of San Francisco. He had an exceptional understanding of hallucinogens and their effects, and he was very clear when he explained them. It was nice to have some clarity on drugs that were still a mystery in many ways. So armed with that information and the vision it had given him, he gathered his followers into a bus caravan, no doubt inspired by Ken Kesey, who had made the idea of the bus famous. You're either on the bus or you're off the bus. Gaskins and his followers crossed the country to preach their vision of a better life. Wherever he went, he gathered new followers, who brought their own buses and joined him on his journey. I never thought of a big yellow school bus as something I would ever want to get into again. Does anyone have good school bus memories? Now he was leading a spiritual convoy across country, like some insane class trip. As anyone with a message does, Stephen and his bus caravan came through Washington, D.C., attracted no doubt by the fact that the government resides there. Who knows, you might convert a congressman or two. Living just outside D.C. at the time, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to see if Gaskins was a wise man or just another snake oil salesman. You never know when you might need some snake oil, even if just to keep the toilet bowl sparkling white. So Ron, my brother, my friends Lenny and Cliff, and Cliff's girlfriend Dee Dee and I headed out to hear what Stephen had to say. The gathering was held at the All Souls Unitarian Church in downtown Washington, D.C. The Unitarians have always been good this way. They are open to all things spiritual. It's the believe whatever you want denomination. There we joined folks of all shapes and sizes and descriptions, from worried parents to hippies to wannabes. There were not a lot of suits in attendance. As I remember it, Stephen gave a lucid and insightful talk about the world we were living in and how we could change it from what we learned from our drug experience. Then he opened the floor for questions, many of which were about personal psychedelics. And, like a New Age Dr. Phil, but without the smarminess, he answered them. Our government, when it came to marijuana and hallucinogens, spent its time freaking people out, rather than helping everyone to understand what they might be taking and how they might be able to deal with the power of such drugs. Maybe this could have been done during arrests for drug possession. Instead of being read their rights, the suspect could be given some tips on how to deal with alternate realities. But dispensing valuable information has never been our government's strong suit. Stephen then went on to describe a utopian vision of a farm that his group had purchased in Tennessee. He invited everyone listening to join up and settle there. They would live off the land and become a self-contained community. Okay, I know. Nowadays, when there is usually an MBA within 10 feet of you, this sounds not only insane, but impossible. Who the fuck would give up everything to follow a drug-taking, long-haired, and bearded hippie? What can I say? It was another century, another time. And maybe, just maybe, people were a little more open to alternative lifestyles. And which is crazier? An ever-growing population of greedy pricks who can't see the social good through the jungle of designer crap that's everywhere as they transform the idea of keeping up with the Joneses into keeping up with the Sun King? Or a bunch of young people, mostly suburban born and bred, who have never even thought of farming, but who jump onto school buses and head toward Tennessee because they are dissatisfied with their lives? Okay, let's call it a toss-up. I am sure that many of you reading this find it unbelievable that such a caravan could exist, and that on a whim, people would pick up their lives and move on. This has happened throughout the history of the world, as well as the history of America. Idealists or religious leaders or nut jobs all have presented another vision of life, and those who are dissatisfied with the one they're living have packed up and headed toward a new one. Religion is based on dissatisfaction with the real world. We don't see so much of it now, I guess, because everyone is so fucking happy. The whole idea captured my friend Cliff's imagination, though maybe not as much as it did his girlfriend. It was an extraordinary alternative, and about as alternative as you could get, considering that Cliff was living in a suburban Maryland apartment complex and was looking for some direction in his life. So in just a matter of days, he and Dee Dee joined the caravan. As for me, I couldn't have done it, as I thought I was going to be a playwright. Besides, I would rather kill myself than be a farmer. That's not to disparage farming. I'm just not built for it, as I need to be indoors as much as possible. And having to start a community from scratch, which on paper might sound thrilling, has no appeal to me. None. Zero. My pioneer spirit leans toward the mental, not the physical, and it extends exactly as far as the internet will take me. If I had to get on one of those wooden boats to get here the way the first European settlers did, I would have taken one look at it and said, fuck it, who needs freedom? Hedging his bets, Cliff said to us, see in a couple of weeks. And he and Dee drove off in their big yellow school bus, as if they were on their way to a Partridge Family reunion. I think it was the path to enlightenment that was attractive to Cliff, and sometimes the path leads to Tennessee. The fact was, the people in the caravan were looking to lead a more spiritual life, not one necessarily defined by God or the rules of organized religion. And do you need God to lead a spiritual life? I suppose so, if you're desperate for an authority figure who's invisible but can be tasted at communion. Can't you just practice what Jesus preaches and live a good and upright life? Isn't that spiritual enough? What if you did do that, and because you didn't believe in God, he sent you to hell? Well, for me, that would surely justify not believing in him in the first place, especially if he's going to be such a prick. Cliff and I kept sporadically in touch while he and Dee were on the road. He returned home at one point for a visit, and our old clique, we called ourselves a clique in semi-mockery of the elitism of it all, got together with him. It was a strained meeting, as we each had different opinions of Cliff's new life, mainly because it wasn't our life, and we didn't know anything about it. For starters, on the farm you were referred to by your proper name. Cliff was Clifford, and Dee Dee was now once again Anita. That was tough to take. He was a Cliff, not a Clifford. No one's a Clifford, are they? I mean, maybe if you're British. When someone you have known and been close to for years, who was nurtured in the system, so to speak, leaves the system, judgments are passed on both sides. How could anyone as smart as you throw your life away like this? Don't you want more? How could anyone as smart as you stay here in the suburbs? What are you thinking? Don't you want more? You're throwing away your education. And what exactly have you done with yours? I thought we were going to change the world. I am at least trying to in my small way. None of this was spoken. It just hung in the air. I think what bugged us most was Cliff's submergence of ego in the farm, which is what they called their community. And then, of course, there was the idea of a guru, which is what Stephen Gaskin seemed to have become. It was completely foreign to the rest of us. It was similar to having your friend give up his American citizenship and move to Russia in the 50s. It just wasn't done. Whether we liked it or not, Cliff was happy. It could have been worse. He could have been a Mooney. A year later, another good friend, Jeff Davis, was heading to see his girlfriend in Bloomington, Indiana, to finalize their wedding plans. He asked me to join him on his road trip, and we decided to stop in and see the farm and Cliff. Jeff saw it as a way to clear his mind, a kind of spiritual tune-up, if you will, before the big day. I saw it as an opportunity to see what my pal Clifford was up to. A group of folks greeted us at the farm's rustic gatehouse, but Cliff and Dee were not among them. The greeters were very gracious, but when they spoke, it was always about the group. What mattered to them was Stephen and the farm and all its inhabitants. What mattered to me was seeing Cliff and Dee Dee. It was like going to a suburban neighborhood to see a friend and being met by the homeowners association. The farm itself was idyllic in a very hippie-esque fashion, a countercultural version of a trailer park. Dirt roads and paths and, yes, school buses were everywhere. The buses were decorated with bright colors and tapestries, and had been transformed into homes that poked out of the trees. It was as if, in Watermelon Sugar, a book by Richard Brautigan, had come to life. There was an undeniable pot smoker's charm to the place, and that is not meant disparagingly. One felt extremely comfortable there, but I wouldn't have wanted to be around if there had been a hurricane, a tornado, or a shortage of pot. I don't know how this would have all seemed to me if I hadn't had a little bit of a buzz on. I imagine this place could have turned really weird really fast. I was thrilled when I finally got to see Cliff and Dee. They were very happy with their new lives. I was working in a theater at that time, which was as close to bohemian as you could get. The theater company Jeff and I were a part of was a communal effort, but Cliff's and Dee's lives made ours look mainstream by comparison. Here were a bunch of well-educated freaks farming while leading a spiritual life with pot. They were certainly moving to the beat of a different drummer. One of the weirdest concepts being tried out there was a foremarriage. This is where two couples got married. It was polygamy without any of the male-centric advantages one finds in Mormon fundamentalism. Right there in Summertown, Tennessee, the state that gave us the Scopes trial, which debated whether evolution should be taught in public schools. And these folks were looking to evolve. All of this was years before Desperate Housewives, the L Word, or The Sopranos began to change the openness of the American psyche. I can't imagine the damage the Ku Klux Klan would have done at the farm if they had known what was going on there. The foremarriage concept was a real shocker. I hadn't come to grips with the two marriage yet. Jesus, what do you tell your parents? I've fallen for a few people? What would Jesus say? I don't think it would make him very happy. There are just too many permutations to deal with. Who can do the math in that kind of marriage? And, as I go for the dumb joke here, the PMS must be overwhelming. It seemed like a hell of a side road for those on a spiritual journey. Stephen had entered into a foremarriage, and what's good for the guru is good for the gander. The farm was also trying another interesting social experiment. For those who were screw-ups in the community, who weren't following the rules, who got out of line, or who were just a communal pain in the ass, there was the rock tumbler. People who broke the rules had to spend time with a group of people who were specially selected to get the transgressor back on the communal track. Basically, it was a group of people who were fun, people who weren't, and people who would probably bore you to tears. Sounds like a party to me. I don't know. I'd rather be chased by bears. I cannot even discuss the diet on the farm. The memory of it still causes mild cramping. It was vigilantly vegetarian and was more than my body could bear. I swear I was eating leaves at one point. But when one shares one's bounty with another, one can't complain. Night fell, and it was magical. Jeff and I walked to where we were staying, a small wooden cabin amidst the buses whose lights appeared like fireflies through the trees. It was really like another world, a nice world to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. The next day we wandered around the farm, watching various farm activities. In the late 60s and 70s, even now for that matter, there are those who give up their office lives to return to the land, to a quieter and simpler life. Quieter? Yes. Simpler? In some ways, sure. But there's a ton of shit that goes into making things so simple. It's a tough life, and these people had started from scratch and were learning along the way. I could see that for my friend Cliff, whose sharp and incisive mind would find working in an office drudgery at best, the farm was an alternative to dying on the vine. He was now planting vines, but he certainly seemed content, much more so than if he had been leading the life of a Washington bureaucrat. That afternoon, the whole group had been summoned for an important meeting with Stephen. It took place on a hillside surrounded by trees, the blue sky and rolling hills as a backdrop. Stephen spoke to the group about a few items on the farm's agenda. Things that needed to be done. A report from the rock tumbler on who was getting out of there and who had to go in. And then Stephen began to talk about his own foremarriage. Apparently the other husband had been having difficulties. Who wouldn't? And was acting out. And this had disturbed Stephen so much that he felt he had no other choice but to banish him from the community, so that the guy could get his head together. Back in those days, we had heads, and we had to get them together. Don't ask. It means just what it sounds like it means. The other husband begged for forgiveness. Stephen was adamant, and it struck me that the foremarriage would now be just a three-marriage. And then it took a real turn to the weird. The other husband said that Stephen either was Jesus Christ, or he was the incarnation of Jesus. Whew. It was a remark that freaked the shit out of me. It was clear that that guy had been in the woods too long. I don't remember Stephen denying his divinity, and that didn't sit well on my already overtaxed stomach. But what made the scene even weirder was that while this discussion was going on, I saw a pure white aura around Stephen's head. That put my brain into the spin cycle. I looked around to see if it was being faked, but there was no way it could have been. We were sitting in the middle of a fucking field. In light of all the information I was receiving, my brain had only one reply. Does not compute. We watched as the other husband hit the road. And after what I had seen, I was ready to take the walk with him. The meeting was adjourned and it was time for supper. Maybe their diet made all of this seem rational to them, but my anus was weeping at the thought of more of that cuisine. We ate, and Jeff and I headed off to our cabin. I understood why Cliff had come here. I just didn't understand why he was staying. I probably should have tried to talk him out of it, but I doubt I could have. Even a utopia, like a good marriage gone bad, can still be seductive. As we lay in the dark in our cute little camp beds, I broached the subject that had been bothering both of us since the meeting. Jeff, I know this is going to sound crazy, I began. You saw the white light, he said quietly. Oh, shit, you did too? It was coming right out of his head. What the fuck was that about? I want a burger. In retrospect, I think that what we saw was less about divinity than it was about hundreds of people pumping the purest energy of attention towards Stephen, and hence, a white light pops out of his head. It came from the folks he was talking to, not from him. He is not the new Messiah. You gotta trust me on this one. He is not Jesus Christ. Like I said, I didn't even believe Jesus Christ was Jesus Christ. The next morning, Jeff and I skipped breakfast. As sad as I was to say goodbye to Cliff, as I didn't know when I would see him again, I was overjoyed to be returning to the material world. Without my even suggesting it, as soon as we left the farm, Jeff drove into the first restaurant we saw. It was one of the best burgers I have ever eaten. It wasn't a spiritual experience. It just felt like home. Reincarnation. I must admit that I find the whole idea of reincarnation very attractive. Very attractive indeed. It works better for me than heaven or hell. Who could blame me? Let's face it, no one wants to go to hell. Sure, it seems like a place that a lot of people should go, but I don't want to be one of them. There's no argument that it's the right place for Hitler, and a lot of his Nazi pals and others of his ilk. But then you have a bunch of duplicitous pricks thrown in with them. That just doesn't seem logical to me. There's a big difference between being a run-of-the-mill asshole and being a truly evil prick. Heaven, on the other hand, seems like a nice enough place. I'm just afraid that it seems a little too nice, that I just get depressed there with nothing to bitch about. And what kind of an afterlife would that be? I sure would like to be an angel for a while, however, and I even believe that angels have watched over me. Still, I think heaven is merely a way station where you do a little time before you are returned to earth. That's where reincarnation comes in. Some people don't like the idea because you come back as someone else, but I'm comfortable with that. Once as me is enough. Now, the theory is that who you come back as depends on how evolved you were when you checked out. If you were a prick the first time around, you might come back as a dung beetle or a gnat. If you were a decent human being who tried to do the right thing, you move up the food chain. Seems pretty straightforward to me. I know it's kind of a crapshoot, but I still like the odds. And I really like the fact that you come back here. I like this place. I know it's not perfect, but if I had my choice, I wouldn't want to go to heaven or hell. I want to come back here. There are more stories here, and more pricks to deal with. Especially the executive at Fox Television, who, after I came into a reading with a makeshift cast for a pilot that had been developed for me, said, "If I knew that the lead was going to be Lewis Black, we wouldn't have had this reading. There's no way he can carry a series. I'd like to come back and waste his time and energy and then kick his ass." What? Am I missing the point or something? The psychic. I am rarely shocked by anything, which is why I think this is an important story. And not to worry. I will not be shocked if any of you don't believe what I am about to tell you. Quite frankly, I won't blame you. Still, I maintain that this is absolutely true, and it's why I believe in something, even though I can't define it. In 1998, I got a call from Tamara Nerby, a terrific comedian and a wonderful friend who lives in Minneapolis. She had recently seen a friend of hers named Michael, who happened to be a psychic. He didn't know who I was. I wasn't on anyone's radar yet, unless you were a complete comedy junkie, and Michael wasn't one of those. In the midst of a conversation the two of them were having, Michael said to her, "You know, you have to stop worrying about your friend Lewis. He's going to do just fine. He's going to have a spectacular career, so you don't have to worry about him anymore." That's when Tamara called me. She assured me that she had never mentioned me to Michael, and therefore I should take this seriously. I don't know which was the bigger shock, that Michael, who didn't know me from Adam, was now talking about me to a good friend, or that big things were going to happen in my career. In retrospect, I have to say the second part was much more shocking, and ultimately more intriguing. When this incident happened, my stand-up career was satisfying, if not huge, and I had accepted the fact that I was about as successful as I was ever going to be, with maybe a few unexpected goodies along the way. I was a moderately established club comic who had what could kindly be called a cult following that had taken years to develop. And I felt that I was lucky enough to be on The Daily Show for a year or so. People were just beginning to pay attention to the show, but it was nowhere near the national phenomenon it was to become. Now, up until this time, I had very little contact with psychics. Friends and friends of friends had told stories of extraordinary readings, but nothing like this. Remember, the guy didn't know me. When I next returned to the Acme Comedy Club in Minneapolis for a week of shows, I asked Tamara to set up a meeting with Michael, just to thank him for the good news and to see how he knew more than my agents or I did. I felt I needed to know which powers that be out in the universe he was chatting up. Tamara, Michael, and I met for lunch. I expected it to be very weird, but it wasn't in the least. It was an afternoon filled with burgers and fries and, if I remember correctly, one Cobb salad. And a lot of really interesting conversation. No boogity, 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 mwahahaha. Michael, it turns out, looks like some kind of a surfer dude. He's just a regular guy, Well, a regular guy who happens to see ghosts. That's right. He sees dead people. Dead people. At least the ones who were still hanging around. He talked about it at lunch in a very matter-of-fact fashion, as if being a psychic was like having a regular office job. The only difference is, instead of looking at a living receptionist and the still-breathing Xerox repairman, he's seeing dead people. That's all, he explained. I asked him about himself first, because the idea of this otherworldly stuff was really quite overwhelming to me. Besides, I have never been one to want to know about the future. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I get spooked enough just living in the present. Or maybe it's because I don't want to know when I'm going to die. Whatever the reason, it just freaks me the fuck out. Especially if the person seems to be some sort of seer, like Michael. But finally, I screwed up the courage and asked Michael how he knew so much about my future. It turns out the answer was simple. Someone who only Michael could see had told him about me. He was so earnest when he explained this, I actually believed him. As weird as it sounds, I had the distinct feeling that this was no parlor trick. And I had just had a long lunch with him, so I knew that this was not a stoner with a Ouija board. For the first time in my life, I believed what I had always thought to be false, that there were people with a gift to see into the future, and that Michael was one of them, that it was something he had cultivated, and that he was on the level. Yes, there was a little part of me that really wanted this tale of a spectacular career to be true. Let's face it, being a club comic and staying in a regular room at the Marriott is nice. Being a theater headliner and staying in a suite at the Four Seasons kicks ass. Really big motherfucking ass. If you ever have the choice, I highly recommend the latter. Anyway, as my conversation with Michael continued, I learned that his mother also had the gift, but at first kept it to herself. Then one day she was walking down the supermarket aisle, and a woman approached her and told her she knew that she had the gift and that she should stop avoiding it. She should cultivate it. It was her path. What's more, as time went on, it would be revealed that Michael's entire family, with the exception of his father, also had the gift. Look, I know you hear these stories all the time. I hear them too. Sometimes it's an alien who wants to tell a human something important to save the planet. Or it's a human telling an alien which detergent to buy. Or it's just an asshole approaching you to tell you something idiotic because he can't keep his mouth shut. But this certainly seemed to be legitimate. Well, as legitimate as something that can't be seen or proven can get. As Michael's story unfolded, I learned that his father was in the army at that time, and that this wasn't the kind of thing he was keen on hearing about. Still, his mom continued to meet with the supermarket lady, and eventually went off with her kids to spend time in a community where others of like mind lived. It was there, in an atmosphere of understanding and acceptance, that she ultimately cultivated her gift. It brought an end to her marriage. But it also brought out the gift that was in all of her children, including the very young Michael. The newly fatherless family moved to a new home where, apparently, Michael said there were some hellish spirits already dwelling. He was afraid of them, as who the fuck wouldn't be at his young age? Or, for that matter, at any age. It's got to be disconcerting to see ghouls that the rest of your playground pals don't see at all. And by ghouls, I mean ghosts that are in flames, screaming, their faces contorted, a bunch of Caspers on a bad bunch of steroids. The secret to dealing with them, I was told, was to show no fear. Well, good luck with that. Eventually, young Michael summoned his courage and overcame his own fear, and learned to live and move easily among the unseen. He told me about this as if he were reciting the multiplication tables or the alphabet. It sure isn't government work unless, of course, you work in Dick Cheney's office. He may not be dead yet, but he's the scariest ghoul I've ever seen. Michael now makes his living as a psychic. He gives readings and clears homes of unwanted ghosts. My favorite of his stories is when a young man called to have his house cleared of a female demon that he was having sex with. Such a demon is called a succubus. Personally, I call it a lucky break. Imagine, a ghost who fucks you. No dinner and drinks or a movie, just sex with a demon. It sounds pretty good. They should advertise certain apartments that way. Two-bedroom, spa-bath, fireplace, succubus included. Where do I sign up? Hey, who wouldn't want to have sex with a ghost? I mean, at least once. Just to see what it's like. According to Michael, this guy did want to give it a try. And apparently, he did it a lot more than once. Making matters worse, the succubus had become attached to him. Which happens because, well, a succubus has feelings too. So when he started seeing a real live woman, the succubus was pissed. And she wasn't shy about showing it. She'd throw shit at this woman. Slam doors in her face, in general, torture her. Imagine what the living girlfriend was thinking. And as the guy, what do you say to her to help her to understand? Hey, baby, I was lonely. She was lonely. So I hooked up with this ghost. Sweetie, it happens. And just out of curiosity, if you fuck a succubus, is that adultery? If a blowjob isn't sex, as many people feel, including a former president who will remain nameless but is married to a woman named Hillary, then is fucking someone who isn't there a bad thing? It can't be counted against you, or can it? I'll have to check with some experts on that. So, how do you get rid of a jealous succubus? According to Michael, you talk to her, you reason with her, you tell her to move the fuck on. And that's just what he did. I told Michael that the next time something like this came up, he should give the succubus my phone number and address. With me, it's all about giving. Since I met Michael, he has called me out of the blue a few times, as if he knows full well what is happening in my life. A few years ago, as I was literally walking out the door of my apartment on my way to Los Angeles to shoot a pilot for CBS, the phone rings. It's Michael. He tells me that he knows that I'm going off to shoot my TV show and that I shouldn't sweat it, as it's going to go well. And even if it doesn't make the schedule, not to worry, more is on the way. I can't imagine, knowing Michael as I do, that he's tracked my career development online. And as I had no website then that announced what I was doing, the explanation I keep coming back to is he just knew. One of his ghost secretaries must have told him. It was a hell of a nice call to get, just to know that the spirit world is keeping an eye on my career. Even more amazing, I came home one night after a discussion with friends over dinner about whether or not I would ever have children. I said it would be nice to have a relationship with a woman who might carry my child to term. On the other hand, I also admitted to my friends that I felt I was already too old to have children. A number of people argue this point with me, but I am not one who believes a kid wants to play catch with a 70-year-old dad. I am not even sure this 70-year-old dad, with the lifestyle I have led, wouldn't hurt himself playing catch. I am, however, pretty sure my sperm is in such bad shape that my baby would be born with a helmet. Besides, I concluded, I seem to be married to my career. So a wife and child are not really in the cards for me. It turns out that while I was having this discussion with my friends at a restaurant, Michael left a message for me at home saying I shouldn't dismiss the idea of having children, that it just might work for me. It was as if he had been sitting with us. Now, whether or not I believe what Michael said, I was stunned. And this was not the first time such a thing had happened with Michael. At our first meeting, Michael said something that truly changed the way I thought about psychics. He spoke to me about my brother's cancer. It was like getting hit by a bus. I remember sitting there, trying to catch what little breath I had left. There was no way in hell Michael could have known about my brother's condition. Ron had been diagnosed with cancer only a few months before. The diagnosis was not good. Though Ron spoke as if it was under control and felt that a cure was imminent. I don't know if that's just what Ron was telling us or if the doctors really felt confident, but Michael alerted me to the fact that my brother's condition was more serious than I was being led to believe. This information was an absolute eye-opener, and it made me more attentive to my brother and his needs. In light of that, I probably should have done more to help my brother. I certainly should have looked into alternatives to the traditional treatments my brother was receiving. But I did what I could at the time, and as I have learned, you can always do more. You just can't ever do enough. Michael helped me understand that lesson, and I can never thank him enough for being so fearless as to share his amazing abilities and that heartbreaking information with me. About a year after my brother passed away, I visited Michael again. We sat around his house. He told me that Ron was there with us, which seemed to confirm what I had been feeling, that Ron was always around. Michael said that Ron wanted me to do movies. Hell, he wasn't alone there. I certainly wanted to do movies as well. Michael said I would be doing movies. And a few years later, I was doing movies. One thing you should know about psychics, they are never quite sure about the timing. In my dealings with Michael, he is pretty right on about what's going to happen to me. He just can't say if it will happen in October or May or even in 2 years. Oh, well, we take what we can. Still, my experiences with Michael have certainly changed the way I look at the world I can't see. To paraphrase Shakespeare, I had begun to learn that there were more things in heaven and earth than I was dreaming of in my philosophy. I found all of this very comforting, much more so than Judaism ever was for me. Maybe I am crazy. Maybe Michael's crazy. But maybe, just maybe, we are both as sane as can be. Well, that's what I like to think, anyway. Oh, by the way, for those of you who are wondering, I have never paid Michael a dime. He is my friend. A friend with an extraordinary gift. It's in the stars. I nearly flunked astronomy in college, and it wasn't my fault. The stars lined up and conspired against me, in a manner of speaking. I used to go to the Moorhead Planetarium on the campus of the University of North Carolina for the lab session of my astronomy class. It was from 2 to 4 on Thursday afternoons. Once we were seated in the vast hall, they would turn off the lights and the night sky would appear above our heads. That's when my professor's gentle voice, filled with years of terminal boredom, brought on by a repetition of facts that he no longer found of much interest, wafted through the air like the sound of crickets. I would fall asleep within minutes. The only time I remained awake in this particular class was when a lovely young lass and I diddled each other's fancy in the dark. These moments gave me a deeper appreciation of anatomy, but it did nothing to pique my interest in astronomy. Besides, it's hard to feel the magic of the night sky when you are wearing glasses that are as thick as mine. Did you see the shooting star, Lewis? Who were they kidding? I could barely see Orion's belt. For that matter, I could barely see my own belt. It should come as no shock when I tell you that I have little interest in astronomy. The same goes for its questionably magical and marginally spiritual cousin, astrology. I get the genesis of the whole thing. The sky is so vast and so majestically beautiful, why wouldn't one create a mythology to explain it? It sounds logical, but I certainly never thought astrology had any real practical application. I put about as much stock in it as I do in the practice of voodoo. I'm sure it works on some vague level, but not enough for me. If there's a reader out there who practices voodoo, however, I beg that you don't try to prove me wrong, especially by putting some wiki-wiki spell on me. If it works for you, I concede I will trust you on this. That said, I have to admit that I once had a very strange encounter with the world of astrology. I was wandering around a drugstore in New Haven when an astrology booklet on the magazine rack caught my eye. It was titled The Love Life of the Virgo, or some such nonsense, and was written by Sidney Omar, one of the more well-known and popular astrologers at the time. I was just coming out of a divorce, so I knew I could use any advice I could get my hands on, even advice I thought had no basis in reality. So, since I was born under the sign of Virgo, I figured I'd leaf through the booklet. Couldn't hurt, I thought. Seeing how my ex-wife was a Leo, I immediately looked up the romantic compatibility of that sign with Virgos. Here's where my eyes popped out of my head. The booklet said the coupling of those two signs would create a rocky union, but that under absolutely no circumstances should a Virgo marry a Leo born on either July 21st or July 22nd. That would lead to disaster. Bing fucking O. My ex-wife was born on one of those days. Coincidence? My dick. This was way too much of a nail-on-the-head sort of shit for me. The booklet was dead on. As you no doubt have surmised by now, mine wasn't a good marriage, and it lasted less than a year. Okay, so let's do the math. There are 365 days in a year, and Sidney Omar, with his charts and graphs and whatever, nails one of the 2 days that my wife shouldn't be born on. What are the odds? That is more than dumb luck. That's unbe-fucking-leavable. Perhaps the stars do know something of our fate, or perhaps Sidney Omar simply knew my ex-wife. Maybe if I'd looked at the love life of Aquarians and the love life of Geminis that day, they also would have warned off marrying anyone born on July 21st or 22nd. Maybe Sidney was just hedging his bet. Either way, it's things like this that have given me pause, and even a nudge towards some kind of faith in something. I haven't sought out astrologers since then, but I read my horoscope every day. You never know. And while I've had no revelations as extraordinary as that first one, I guess it's just a reminder that I don't know everything. And neither does my shrink. So maybe, from time to time, I should listen to the stars. A call from Norman Lear. A few years ago, I met Norman Lear and his son at the Aspen Comedy Festival, which was a thrill for me, as he is a hero of mine. He was the creator of some of the finest television comedy ever produced, and some of the most intelligent. His work was not only funny, it was often groundbreaking and at times profound. His All in the Family told the tale of Archie Bunker and his family, a lovable bigot who was in a constant battle with the changing world around him, and his daughter and son-in-law, who lived under his roof. Norman used this character to confront all sorts of issues that were rarely discussed on television, even on the news or in any other public forum. Racism, sexism, war, women's liberation, homophobia were all fodder for his satiric wit. He came up after seeing my act, and I tried to control the voice screaming in my head, "It's Norman Lear! It's Norman Lear! It's Norman Lear!" This happens when I meet people I truly admire. He told me how much he and his son enjoyed my comedy, and I tried not to jump up and down. One day, a few months later, the phone rang. "Hello, Lewis. This is Norman Lear." "Well, this is it," I thought. Finally, the breakthrough I have been waiting for. He had some brilliant TV project he was working on, and I would be perfect for it. I will be the new Archie Bunker. I will be the new Maude. I will cork up and be the new Sanford. I wanted to scream, "Yes, fuck! Whatever it is, I'll do it!" Instead, in as calm a voice as I could muster when talking to a creative legend, I said, "Hi, Norman, how you doing?" "I am fine," he said. "I have kind of an unusual request for you. I don't know if anyone has ever asked you to do something like this, but..." "Yes, fuck, whatever it is, I'll do it," echoed through my brain. "Would you perform at my son's bar mitzvah? You met him at Aspen. He's a huge fan of yours. You're his favorite comic, and the present that he wants most is for you to perform at his bar mitzvah." That, in a nutshell, is the story of my career. Norman Lear finally calls, and it's to perform at his son's bar mitzvah. Adam Sandler did the wedding singer, and it was a huge hit on the big screen. I get reality, not even a reality show. And then Norman asked, have you ever done a bar mitzvah? What's the going rate? What's the going rate for a bar mitzvah? How about a television pilot? I thought, should I call my agent and have him negotiate? Of course not. I had no going rate for doing a bar mitzvah. So I just did it. I did Norman Lear's son's bar mitzvah. No one, anywhere on the planet, has that on their resume. Sure, Mr. Pacino, you did Godfather 1, 2, and 3. But did you ever perform at a bar mitzvah? No, I don't think so. So, why did I agree to perform at Norman Lear's son's bar mitzvah? Just to say that I did it. That's why. And because Norman is someone I respect and admire. And because his son is a terrific kid. Hey, I was his favorite comic, and I was his present. You can't say no to that. How many times, outside of a high-security prison, are you somebody's present? I wish Bob Newhart had performed at my bar mitzvah. Oh, and I needed the gig. Seriously. And the money was good. Much better than I was making at the time. It was a good gig, but definitely a strange one. I took the stage where the band had been playing, and the bar mitzvah boy and his friends all crowded in front of me on the dance floor, while the adults sat off to my right. I was entertaining a group of 13-year-olds. So I cleaned up my act and forged ahead. I even dusted off some of my Jewish material that I hadn't used in years. The crowd enjoyed themselves, but I didn't kill. I don't think you can kill at a bar mitzvah. Bo and Peep. Religion is supposed to provide solace. Why, then, do so many people who practice religion end up killing themselves? It is a question that has been nagging at me for some time. Perhaps it's the sense of failure that overwhelms them when they can't measure up to the kind of life they were told they should be living. And coupled with either a chemical glitch in their makeup or an overzealous religious leader, they decide to end it all. Or maybe they are opting for the promise of an eternal life they believe will be so much better than the veil of tears they are forced to endure in this world that they design their own demise. No one knows the body count for sure, but I would hasten to guess the numbers are up there. Adding to those totals are the religious groups where a number of people make the choice together. The suicide pact orchestrated by Jim Jones immediately comes to mind. A total megalomaniac psychopath, Jones took 1,000 members of his People's Temple flock from San Francisco to a life in Guyana. There, he convinced them all to drink cyanide-laced Flavor-Aid in 1978, resulting in one of the largest mass suicides in recorded history. And this was a church that was considered extremely progressive and extraordinarily integrated, proving that it is not just the ignorant out there who are capable of displaying extraordinary stupidity. Now, before I go on, I want to clear something up. Back in 78, Kool-Aid got a very bad rap. It was referred to as the drink of choice at the People's Temple that day. That's because nobody had ever heard of Flavor-Aid, which, if truth be told, actually competes with Kool-Aid. Hence the confusion. But now that you know, please don't make the mistake again. Another group that caught the world's attention was a semi-religious one with overtones of alien fantasy called Heaven's Gate. They were by far my favorite. They were the best. Why? They were homegrown. Nobody grows nut jobs with the same panache as the good old U.S. of A. To begin with, their leader was Bo, and his partner was Peep. Go ahead, look it up. It's in the public record. They were Bo and Peep, and they went around the country holding meetings in order to increase their flock. I don't know about you, But if I was in a meeting and the guy in charge said, "My name is Bo, and this is Peep," that would be the end of the meeting for me. I'd be out of there. Unless, of course, there were sheep. And Peep would have needed to be dressed appropriately, and that means complete with a bonnet. Most definitely, the bonnet would be very important.